It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
I'm doing great. Glad to be here. And next week, Zeb will be back with us.
Yes, he will. He'll be back with us. He'll be back and he's all going to be sunburned.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think we need to have you move in just a smidge closer.
How's that? Is that better?
Much better. There
okay.
We go. Yeah, we got the thumbs up from the switchboard.
Okay, we're good to go.
So what do you have today?
I want to say hi to a couple of people.
Okay.
One is Emerson, who actually told me a story about, and I'm going to be talking about buffalo hunters today.
Okay.
So he told me a story about a guy named Porter Rockwell, who had heard you could not kill a buffalo by shooting it in the head. And so he actually, he actually got ran ahead of a buffalo herd and got in front of a buffalo, shot it right between the eyes, and all there was a puff of dust. And that old buffalo just kept on a running.
Right.
And Porter had to get out of the way. So, and then I want to say thanks to Austin, who gave me a suggestion for a show, and also Alan, who gave me a suggestion for a show. But today, we're going to talk about, this will be my last session on buffalo, I promise. And I'm going to talk about, it is. So I'm going to talk about the shooters, the hide hunters, okay? So by the summer of 1872, literally thousands of buffalo hunters had converged on the Great Plains, and they had or would soon earn names like Buffalo Bill Comstock, Buffalo Bill Cody, Cross-Eyed Joe, Apache Bill, Buffalo Curly, Wyatt Earp, Pat Garrett, Crooked Nose, Jack McCall, just kind of an interesting bunch of guys. Now, different hide hunters worked in different ways, but the ones with a head for business started their own outfits. An outfit was usually managed by the shooter. He'd hire a couple of skinners and a camp tender. A six-man outfit would depart civilization with, they'd usually have two or three ox-drawn carts loaded with barrels of coffee, salt, sugar, flour, camp equipment, and skinning equipment. And they had bullet-making materials. They would have five 25-pound kegs of DuPont gunpowder, 800 pounds of lead, hundreds of brass casings, and thousands of cartridge primers. So they were ready to go. So heading into dangerous country, a hide-hunting outfit might travel with another outfit or two just for safety's sake, but while the wagons headed toward a general area where buffalo herds were expected to be hanging around, the shooters would cut broad circles on horseback, scouting for signs of buffalo. Now, the scouts might be gone from the wagons for several days at a time, and they would return to their rendezvous point only when they found a herd or they found a good trail. Now, when they did find buffalo, they didn't just storm into the herd with their guns ablaze. They were more calculated than that. First, they'd check out the lay of the land and find a good campsite, preferably in a deep gully or a canyon where they'd be hidden from the Indians and the buffalo. They also needed a water source and plenty of buffalo chips or wood for a cooking fire. When the camp set up and everything was ready, the shooter would get some sleep and then ride out early in the morning. Now, they liked the 44, 45, and 50 caliber rifles that were made by Sharps and Springfield. And they carried hundreds of cartridges. A lot of the shooters actually liked cartridge belts that they would wear around their waist. And a belt would hold, about 42 rounds. And a shooter might wear two or else put his ammo into a bandolier worn across his chest. Now, a shooter would tether his horse somewhere close to the herd, but out of sight and, more important, downwind. Then he'd study the herd. Which way was the wind blowing? Were they feeding or sleeping? Were they holding still? Were they walking? Preferably, the buffalo would be still. That was the best situation. If there were thousands of animals, the shooter would select a particular band off to the side of the main bunch. A group of about 50 was a good number. They liked that size. Then he'd check, he'd use creek beds or sagebrush clumps or stands of cottonwoods to stalk within a couple of hundred yards. If he got too close, he'd risk spooking the herd. If it was too far off, he'd risk making bad hits and just wounding a buffalo. So it was a kind of an art to be able to get in close enough, but not too close. Well, he'd get his gear all set and ready before he started shooting. He needed a solid rest, some place to steady the barrel of his gun. He might use a wadded-up jacket, or sometimes I've seen pictures where they take a couple of sticks and cross them and rest their gun in the crook of those two cross sticks. Sometimes they'd get a mound of packed snow or even mounds of buffalo chips, anything to rest their gun so they'd have a steady way to shoot. Well, he'd take off his ammo belt and lay it next to him. Then he would try to determine the herd's leader. Now, usually, and this kind of surprised me, usually it was an older cow. I figured it'd be a bull, but it was usually an older cow. And the leader might be out in front of the herd and setting the pace of movement. And that's the one he wanted to hit first. Now, if the buffalo were bedded down, the shooter might not know who the leader was, and if that was the case, he'd pick a buffalo on the outer, distant edge of the herd, probably the farthest away that he would shoot. Now, the shooter would send his bullets through the target, through the buffalo's lungs, and these were called, quote, lights. And I'm not sure why they called it that, but that's what they did. Now, a lung-hit buffalo usually wouldn't run, but would just take a few steps before sinking down and tipping over. Now, it would kick for a second, and then it would be still. Now, the fallen buffalo's herd mates would respond in a number of ways. The buffalo might walk up and smell the blood. They might act very aggressively toward the downed animal and actually gore it. I mean, you know, and that surprised me too. Or they might take off in a wild stampede. And of course, that was the last thing the hunter wanted, was to have one down and the rest gone. Well, the goal was to have the herd milling about in confusion, no idea where to go, no idea where the danger was coming from, and as soon as one of the buffalo showed an initiative toward leaving, the shooter would pull a bullet in its lungs. Now, if the buffalo wanted to travel in a particular direction, the shooter would drop an animal or two in the path and try to change his mind. And if a buffalo ran, the shooter would try to knock it down in a hurry. If he fired more than a round or two a minute, the rifle barrel would get too hot. And that's when they would actually get snow, if it was handy, and put it into the barrel of the gun. Or if they had a canteen, sometimes they'd pour water down the barrel because they're going, you know, two, maybe three a minute, usually two a minute. And so that barrel would get pretty hot.
Yeah, but wouldn't that warp the metal?
Not evidently, because that's what they did to cool the barrel. Yeah.
Wow.
But when a herd started moving away from a shooter, it was said to be, quote, adrift. Now, the shooter would follow along, and he would actually go from downed buffalo to downed buffalo so he could use the carcass as a place to rest his rifle, and it also hid him. So he would just kind of follow, and he had to be careful because a half-dead or stunned buffalo might get up and charge him. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a minute. There are documented reports of shooters killing 100 or 200 buffalo within an hour or two, but 30 or 40 was usually considered considered a good day's shooting. Shooter didn't want to go too far over that number because he was limited by how many hides his skinners could remove. And you didn't want to leave them overnight because the buffalo, they would bloat. The hides would get tight. They'd be hard to pull off. And if you left them overnight, sometimes wolves would come in and tear them apart. Or if it was cold, they might freeze. And then, again, hard to get them off. Now, in really good hunting, skinners might make upwards of $20 a day. They usually got 25 or 30 cents per hide. Those skinners from Mexico would do it for 20 cents a hide. And the skinners followed along the shooter's path with a wagon. Now, some skinners drove a big steel rod through the buffalo's head. Now, picture this. They would anchor it to the ground. Then they'd make some skinning cuts on the hide and actually pull the hide off with the draft team, with the horses. They'd actually just kind of rip it off. Now, a lot of the skinners didn't like this method. They just skin the animal slice by slice with a knife, and that seemed to be really the most effective. So the hides had to be pegged out to dry, meat side up and fur side down. In wet weather, the skinner flip-flopped the hides back and forth until it was dry. The skinners would either do the hide staking right where the buffalo fell, or they'd haul the hides back to camp, and they'd do it there. Now, if the ground was frozen, they might actually use rocks to stretch out the hide. Now, a skinner might carve his initials in the tissue so they'd know which skinner had done which, so they'd get credit. When the hides were dried out, usually after a week or so, they'd stack them into piles that were 8 feet high. They'd cut leather cords from fresh hides and then run the cords through the holes cut in the bottom and top hides so they could cinch the stack down tight. And that's how they hauled them to market. Now, the hides were ready to be hauled to the railroad depot. After a few months out or a season, a hunting outfit could have upwards of 4,000 or 5,000 hides. Now, the prices varied. When the hides were really flooding in, they were sometimes dropped to a dollar a hide or less. And that wasn't much money. And, toward the end of the hide hunting era, when the buffalo left were in Montana, the only ones, the hunters were getting as much as $3.50 for a cow, $2.50 for a bull, $1.50 for a yearling, and 75 cents for calves. And for some reason, they liked the cow hides better than any of the others. So maybe a thousandth of that that meat actually went to market. So tons and tons of meat just went to waste, just rotted. Yeah, it really is. Now, occasionally they would have a load of brined buffalo tongues, okay? 25 cents a piece, or smoked hams, 3 cents a pound, but it just wasn't profitable to handle the actual meat of the buffalo. Now, the hide hunters were some of the, what you'd call the grubbiest people on the face of the earth, okay? A little rough.
Yeah, how did they go?
Well, I'm going to tell you how they did that. Long hair was a fad among them. They all had long hair. Their blankets would get so full of lice and bed bugs that they would lay them on ant hills so that ants could carry away the larvae. And that actually worked. I've heard of that happening with even with cattle drives. If you got lice, you could put your clothes over an anthill. But the hunters would often eat little else besides buffalo. Now, the beginners, or what we'd call tenderfeet, would start out eating the prime cuts. But within months, they suffered nutritional deficiencies that caused their tongues to break out in lesions. And after a while, they learned to be more like the Indians. They'd eat the liver, the kidney, and the glands because of the vitamins that were in that. And some hunters seasoned the meat with gunpowder for kind of a peppery effect. Okay.
Now, we got the term, "I'm going to pepper you."
Yeah. So now picture this. Often the stench of rotting carcasses around their camps would prevent them from eating. And again, flies would get bad enough to just run off their horses. In wet weather, the hides would rot. In hot weather, the hides would rot. Mm-hmm. And when there was snow on the ground, the hunters would smear mixtures of gunpowder and buffalo grease under their eyes to cut the glare, just like you see with a football player now.
Right.
In blizzards, they would gut out freshly killed buffalo carcasses and spend the night inside the carcass to keep from freezing to death. Yeah. And they waterproofed their boots and clothes with raw buffalo fat. And they greased their lips with that as well.
That would keep you from licking.
You wouldn't lick your lips, no. Yeah. Now, the job had its dangers. Hide hunters sometimes died from rabies after bitten by skunks who came into the camp by the smell of the meat. And along the Yellowstone River near Glendive, Montana, a buffalo hunter was killed by a buffalo that woke up after the hunter had already cut out his tongue for dinner. The buffalo wasn't dead.
Oh, my goodness.
Got up and gored the hunter.
I'll show you.
Yeah. Three hide hunters were killed in a prairie fire. I mean, I used to work for the BLM on fire crew, and a fire can move across prairie. You can't outrun it.
Yeah.
So two hide hunters from Wisconsin froze to death in Nebraska. Their companion lost both feet. In the Easter blizzard of 1873, upward of 100 hide hunters froze to death on the southern Great Plains. I mean, that's a lot of men.
That is.
Now, the hide boom only lasted a dozen years before the buffalo ran out. The first big hunting push was in the vicinity of Dodge City in 1871. That was the first big year. The hide hunters killed so many animals so close to town that the residents complained about the stench of rotting carcasses. It would have had to drift into town. You know, that couldn't have been good. But that winter, 500,000 buffalo hides were shipped out of Dodge. The hunters spread out from there along the South Fork of the Platte River. Hundreds of buffalo hunters actually lined 50 miles of riverbank, and they used fires to keep the buffalo from getting to the water at night. In 4 daytime periods, they gunned down 50,000 of these buffalo that were trying to get to the river to drink. Well, once the railroad made it to Miles City, Montana in 1881, word spread that the core of the last great herd had been tapped. Hide dealers calculated that 500,000 buffalo ranged within 150 miles of town, up by Miles City. Soon there were 5,000 hide hunters killing the animals. A herd that was estimated at 75,000 head crossed the Yellowstone River 3 miles outside of Miles City, and they were moving north in a big herd. The hunters stayed with the buffalo, and they pushed them along. Now, here's where accounts vary. Been anywhere from 0 to 5,000 buffalo were all that were left by the time the herd reached Canada. And by 1883, one remaining large herd had moved into the Black Hills. It started out as 10,000 buffalo and was quickly reduced to 1,000 by the white hide hunters. And then the Sioux warrior Sitting Bull and 1,000 of his men on the herd killed the rest. So, you know, that's kind of the end of the hide hunting. And as I mentioned last week, you know, these hides were being used by tanneries and ordered by tanneries even as far away as England to be used for whatever. And, you know, I also mentioned how the Indians, they used every part of the buffalo. They did not waste anything.
Well, and that's what makes it so sad is that these hide hunters wasted so much of it.
Right, exactly. And the Indians, it was a sacred thing to kill an animal, and they praised the Great Spirit for providing this animal.
Right.
I got a little bit more about the buffalo tongue. I thought you might like that.
Okay.
So the buffalo tongue were prepared for shipment in different ways. They were packed fresh into wooden barrels between layers of salt. They were brined in a mixture of water, sugar, and salt. Then they were smoked like bacon and packed into barrels. And they were air-dried with salt and then submerged in barrels full of the brine. And so that's how they were able to take care of them. Now, a popular brine recipe for a 19-gallon barrel was water, 2 pounds of sugar, and a tablespoon of saltpeter or potassium nitrate. As a food additive, this saltpeter inhibits the bacterial growth and gives meat kind of a reddish color. And, of course, it's also a principal component of gunpowder. And in the days of eating buffalo tongue, saltpeter was produced from various forms of decomposing organic matter like stale urine, pigeon and bat guano. Now it's produced through what they call the Haber process, which uses atmospheric nitrogen to produce ammonia and in turn saltpeter. But despite its more appetizing modern production method, the use of saltpeter in food has kind of waned in recent decades thanks to concerns over health. It's been actually linked to kidney disease, anemia, heart problems. So things have changed a lot from the days of preparing tongue for sale in the East or wherever. I've never eaten it myself.
I
would mind trying a bite, but I'm not going to order it in a restaurant. I can tell you that. So that's kind of the story about the buffalo from beginning to kind of to the end.
People blasted the Indians and saying how savage they were and uncaring and mean to their opposing tribes and stuff like that. But if you really think about it, though, in this instance here where the buffalo were left and not used, the Indians really did appreciate what they had, what was given. And if they took a life, whether it be a deer, a buffalo, an elk, whatever, they gave thanks for that. They appreciated that life that was given for their sustenance. And they did use every part of it that could possibly be used in their sustaining of their lives.
Exactly. If you think about all the buffalo, there's something that goes on a little beyond the buffalo, and that's their bones.
Yeah.
And when the hide hunters were done, of course, they left these great big piles of bones, huge piles. And what happened was they would actually take some of this, make bone china out of the powdered bone. They would purchase the bones from the pioneers out there that would gather it up and sell it.
Wow.
But the bones gave American and English-produced porcelain a kind of a translucency and a whiteness that could actually compete with Oriental china that had been imported.
So and they figured out how to do that, too.
Yeah. And other big consumers of the buffalo bones were the sugar, wine, and vinegar industries. They'd been using wood ash to neutralize acids. But in the early 19th century, they actually found that bone ash did a better job of making sugar more shiny and wine less cloudy. They also used buffalo bone and ash in fine-graining polishing agents and baking powders. So there was a whole new thing that developed from the wake of the dead buffalo.
Wow. That's amazing.